Welcome back, everyone, to the Dungeon Masters Block, the place where we come to talk about the Dungeon Master, the most important person in the game, the only person capable of playing God, killing characters, and lowering the egos of all of the other players at your table. I'm one of your hosts, Dungeon Master Chris.
And I am another host, joining for the very first time, DM Main Prize.
I am so excited that you're here for this episode, Phil, because you get to be a part of our racial profiling episodes, where we talk about dwarves this week. And who better to come and talk about that than the man with the most legendary beard I have ever seen in my life?
Well, I wouldn't go too far. Joe Moniak does have a quite powerful beard.
That's true.
My love of dwarves, I don't know if it knows any bounds. I did actually build a small forge in my backyard just so I could smash metal. So
to make yourself as much of a dwarf as possible.
Yes.
That's awesome. I didn't know that about you, but that just took on a whole new level in my book that you have a forge in your backyard.
I do.
That's awesome. And so we are going to be talking about dwarves who smash metal and burn things and break things and whatnot this week on The Meat. But before we do that, we have some five-star reviews. So our first five-star review comes from somebody named Big Demarest, and they write A Whole New World, 5 stars. I have been a DM for about a year and found this podcast a few months ago. What a find. I love how you teach listeners to look at everything they love around them and find a way to put it into their gaming world. From video games, cartoons, movies, fairy tales, and fables, you have shown me how all the nerdy things I love are basically building my D&D world for me. Keep the show going, and I also love that you keep it classy and clean. So thank you, Big Damaris. We really, really do appreciate you as a fan writing in with a 5-star review like that. But, as we always do, we now have to go to the savory part of this episode, the meat.
I'm starving. We ain't had nothing but maggoty bread for 3 stinking days.
Yeah. Why can't we have some meat?
Carve it up!
Just a mouthful!
No!
Looks like meat's back on the menu, boys!
So welcome back to The Meat. This week, like we said, we are talking all about dwarves. And dwarves, I think, Phil, the reason that I asked you to come onto the show is because, like me, you have a lifelong and deep passion for dwarves. I'm not sure when your passion started for it, but my passion for dwarves started in middle school when that was one of the first characters that I was ever handed, along with having read The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings books. They were just instrumental to my love for the dwarven kind. So I'm really excited to talk about the dwarves this week, as I know you are, and you have a part of the dwarven identity that I don't have. You have a crazy beard that is going on about you.
That is true.
I do not have that at all. I've tried, and it's like somebody took a razor to major parts of the dwarf's beard. So I would look like a fool of a dwarf if I were to ever try and do that. And so dwarves have quite a history behind them. They have been around in D&D forever, but not, I would say, as glorious as they are today. As most things, after they've been expanded upon for years and years and years, they just get better and better and better and better. They have their roots in Norse and Teutonic mythology. So as we were looking up this episode, there were some really cool pictures. If you ever want some ideas of what dwarves looked like in this Norse and Teutonic mythology, go type in pictures of what these dwarves look like, and you will have inspiration for days as far as what you could add into your world for dwarves. In particular, the dwarves of D&D, they find their roots in the Germanic stories, the Ring of Nibelungen, and the Brothers Grimm fairy tale, as some of us are very familiar with, Rumpelstiltskin. So those were where the ancestors of the dwarves came from for Dungeons & Dragons. And they have been available in all editions of D&D. And now, in 5th edition, they're even starting to come out with some subclasses for these dwarves that we find. And as you are probably aware, there's other sorts of playable characters as well as monsters that are found in the monster manuals. I think of the Dwerger, for example. Phil, have you ever used a Dwerger within a campaign night that you've run?
So I've never used the Dwerger. My players are very baby players. They just hit level 5, and I don't know if I'm confident to take them into some place as scary as where the Dwerger would be. So no, I haven't used them yet, but one day they will make their rise.
Yeah, I remember playing against them for the first time in one of DM Mitch's campaigns. We were in the Underdark, and so when you say they are found in very scary places, there are not many scarier places to be found than the Underdark. Like, you go into the Underdark, things just get dark and twisted and messed up super quickly. And so
yeah,
when you think of Dwarger, that's where they are. Look them up. They are these terrifying creatures.
Absolutely.
But what we really want to talk about is what makes the dwarves great. What makes Phil and I want to come to talk to you, the listener, about dwarves in particular? And Phil, I'll let you start, because the first thing we want to talk about is something that you know a lot about.
I do know a pretty decent amount, and that's going to be talking about the beards. As Chris said, he is sadly the, you know, Moradin may have cursed him as a youth, and he was never able to grow a luscious beard. But I
like to say I was estranged from the dwarven kind, and they shaved my beard off and put a curse on me to never be able to grow one.
Yeah, I don't know what crime you committed in their society, but it must have been heinous.
I must have defamed somebody's beard somewhere, and that was my punishment. I accidentally probably set fire to my father's beard when we were playing around the stove or something like that.
Yeah,
I have no idea.
That's
it
unacceptable.
Had to be something terrible.
So yeah, the beards are very much an iconic part of dwarves, and kind of to touch on that, if you think about, you know, The Hobbit, you kind of mentioned that's where part of your love for dwarves came from. My mom read it to me when I was a kid, and I just loved that there were these 13 dwarves helping the Hobbit kind of find his courage. So if you just think about other forms of literature, Artemis Fowl, Discworld, the World of Warcraft video game, Warhammer 40K, all of these have dwarves, and in all of them, the dwarves all have beards. It's very much a staple of what it is to be a dwarf, regardless of what you're looking at. In Artemis Fowl, their beards can actually, you can take the hair out of their beards and use it to heal wounds.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So there's a lot of really cool stuff that exists around the beards. You can put beads in your beards. I have been known to do that from time to time. It's just a way to have something awesome that represents the dwarven race. And beards can be intimidating. They can also be warm and cuddly, you know. Children love beards because they think of Santa Claus, so there's no reason as a dwarf to not grow a beard.
Well, and I just imagine, too, these beards that these dwarves have, you know, I kind of just imagine this point being something that we said, their beards are awesome and moving on, but there's so much depth that you can go to with their beards, because I would imagine that they can be used, like you said, in a very scary way, like going off to war. I almost imagine that they, you know, it can't just be flopping around everywhere in front of them. They might get it tangled in something or caught. So they have to do something really crazy with it, make it look a certain way to intimidate their opponent. Or you think of maybe there's, you know, along the lines of it being, you know, an eldership of dwarves. Like maybe the elders have different styles of beards that they have to do in order to hold that position. They have to have it braided in a certain way or cut at a, you know, fear the scissors, obviously, but like they might have to have it styled in a certain way, and maybe the darker the beard, the higher regard you're held in. Maybe the redder the beard, the higher regard you're held in. I mean, there's so many things that you could do with a dwarf and his beard to really add a lot of flavor into the game, which I think we oftentimes as both DMs and as players, we often just kind of graze past that and we say he has a beard.
Mm-hmm.
But as we'll talk about later with NPCs, this can be something that is very memorable, I think, for players when they come across the dwarf.
It absolutely can be, yeah.
You describe the beard in a really eccentric way, they'll never forget it. They'll always want to come back to that dwarf, especially if it's something that's iconic to them.
And it's kind of like, especially with the describing of NPCs, maybe the one thing that the Hobbit movie got right was that they gave each dwarf a very specific type of beard. Whenever they were on screen, no matter how hectic or chaotic the CG was, you'd be able to know which CG beard was attached to which dwarven character.
Right.
And also, like you said, you can do so much with role playing with the beards, whether it's like social structures, you know, who is ahead of who, or you could even do something along the lines of like how gender is decided in Lord of the Rings trilogy. Aragorn, you know, is making a joke to Eowyn about, you know, it's the beards. He says when referenced, like maybe dwarven women have beards, or maybe like gender in dwarven society is not decided by anatomy, but decided by beard. You know, you could choose to have a beard or not. So you could really, and that could play on, if your characters are not dwarven and they step into dwarven culture, really making mistakes and stepping on people's toes because they don't know how the social structure work because it's all based around the beard.
Yeah, it's like when we go to a different culture and something that we would find as acceptable is no longer acceptable in that culture. And that beard, you could play off of that quite a bit. Yeah.
And also about taking the beard into battle, and I totally agree, you want to have it, you might want to have it, you know, neatly braided and maybe tucked behind your armor, but there's also the flip side of that where maybe you put, like, razor blades in it and you whip it around, you know, you whip your beard back and forth.
I whip my beard back and forth, oh my gosh.
Exactly, and you use that as a weapon, and maybe that does, like, 1d4 slashing damage.
Yeah, you could do it to yourself, too, if you accidentally hit yourself.
Yeah. There would be some saving throw, I'm sure.
Yeah, right, because you could, let's be honest, if you're a dwarf, you could probably control your beard, or you have the ability to not take damage from that sort of thing.
Right.
But as we talk more about dwarves, like, another feature of them that's really iconic is they are oftentimes referred to as the strength of the mountain. And when we say that, we mean that they are like a mountain. They are strong. They are stocky. They are built as a symbol of power. I think that's one thing that I really appreciated about dwarves, because for a long time too, I was not that. I'm still not overly strong, but I remember being a small, scrawny middle schooler, well behind in development of his friends, and to be able to play this character in D&D that I could just kick anything's butt that I came up against, that was amazing for me. I love to be able to do that. I love to be able to be strong, to pick up heavy things, to smelt things in really cool ways. Like, that was one reason why I fell in love with dwarves and what made them so great in my mind.
Yeah. I think it's not only the strength of the mountain, but also you can talk about and consider the idea of, like, the durability. Like, mountains don't go away.
Right.
They're hanging out for way longer than most everything else on a planet. So, like, the durability of the dwarf, you know, they're going to stay in the fight for a long time. They are tough. They're very, you know, they're made of stone stuff.
Right, because, you know, you think of earthquakes in our world. Like, they don't destroy mountains. They don't flatten mountains. They almost reinforce them or change them in such a way that they're stronger afterwards. They make them taller. They make them stronger. And I kind of see that with dwarves, too, with, you know, having high constitutions and high strength. Like, they rebound from things really well. So they might get knocked around or jostled a little bit by some sort of, you know, quote unquote earthquake that hits them. But because of their long resilience, because of their strength, they can move on and prosper from those things really well.
Yeah, very true. So tell me about the lifespan of dwarves.
Well, it's very long. They live extremely long lives. And because they live really long times, and because, like we said, they are the strength of the mountain, that means they have really long memories. So they remember things. Like, they might be fearful of having relationships with humans, or they might just view humans as lesser than because they live, you know, 200 years less than what a dwarf does. So it's almost like that, you know, and then we have elves, which are a totally different story, that live much, much longer. But they have this, you know, this moment within them where it's like, if you were to harm them, if a family were to do something to a dwarf, that family might have to suffer the repercussions of an angry dwarf for 3, 4, 5 generations, all because of what somebody did a really, really long time ago, because they're able to live long lives and have long memories.
Yeah, and that gives kind of lends credence to the kind of, you know, there's in a lot of fantasy, it's very tropey to have the elves and the dwarves not like each other very much. And that kind of makes sense, because if I was a human and I wronged an elf, in a, you know, 50, 60 years, I would be dead. And then, you know, 50, 60 years after that, my kids would be dead. So kind of that grievance is going to pass away with generations. But with an elf, if an elf wrongs a dwarf, that elf is going to be around, you know, like, kind of in that dwarf's face, or at least the shame of that, for way longer than it would be with a human or one of the, like, the less long-lived races.
Well, and I wonder too, you know, we talk about them being the strength of the mountain. Like, they change and they move, but they stay the same essentially the whole time. So it's like, you wrong somebody, I wonder if it's even harder because that became a part of that, you know, quote unquote mountain, for it to fall away in the future.
Yeah.
So if somebody were to come up to you like 5 generations later and they found out why you were so crass to them, or you were so hatred, you know, you spewed hatred towards them, they could come and be like, hey, I'm really sorry for that thing, but that's not me. And they might say, it doesn't matter. Like, I'm sorry, but it doesn't matter. Like, I still hate you because of what happened.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, you know, you might be able to, if you were around for a long time, if you proved over a long period of time, because dwarves live for a really long time, if you were to set it as a prerogative for your family for generations to come to make amends right, who knows? You know, it might take a really long time, but it could work. You could become back on the dwarf's good side. So there's a lot that could be played around with that, with dwarves and their long memories. So, Phil, when we think about dwarves and we think about things that motivate dwarves, I think there's a couple of things that listeners can pull out. But if you had to say they were motivated by a few things, what would you say those things were?
The top three, kind of from my understanding of D&D, and I am a pretty new DM, but what I've gathered so far is that their gods are pretty important to them. That's a huge connection to, you know, their entire society. So the gods, also gold, you know, you could also just, you know, simplify that as treasure of any kind they're going to really love.
Yeah, right.
And then also kind of their clan, their family, you know, as the, we kind of talked about grievances and grudges, like that's going to be supported by your entire clan most of the time. So gods, gold, and clan. I mean, there's numerous other ones you could list, but I'd say those are the biggest three.
Yeah, so when we think of the dwarven god, who do we primarily think of?
I'm sure most D&D players primarily think of Moradin. It's not who comes to my mind instantly because I'm obsessed with Tolkien, but Moradin's the big boy in our D&D settings.
Yeah, I recognized that when we were texting yesterday beforehand. I said something of like, Moradin is ready for us. And then what did you send back to me?
I was like, I think you mean Aule or something.
Yeah.
Some reference to the kind of like the god character in Tolkien's mythology that created the dwarves.
Yeah.
But no, Moradin's our man for sure.
Yeah. Moradin is definitely our man. And so when I think about Moradin, I think about this god who kind of looks like a dwarf, kind of acts like a dwarf, is very like lawful good like many dwarves are. He's very prominent with creation and smithing and stonework and things like that. And it only makes sense for the dwarves to care about those similar types of things. And so we talk about treasure. That could be really anything. That could be amazing pieces of stonework that they really, really treasure. So you talk about things not to touch when you're in a dwarf's home. It'd probably be one of their treasures that they've created. That might be why I have a short beard. I may have touched something of my father's and broke it at a very young age. But I think about the clan thing too. Like, that is, for many of us, family's a really big deal in our lives. So it's like we translate that into D&D as DMs, especially if you have a dwarven character. You want your players to really get into role-playing, mess with their family as a dwarf.
Yeah.
See what happens. Like, I think treasure is one thing, yeah, but you talk about like somebody who is flesh and blood, a part of your family, mess with the clan of a dwarven character. And if they really understand what dwarves are like, they will throw a fit and it will be some of the most fun role-playing you've ever seen in your life as a DM.
I absolutely agree.
When we think about dwarves, we have to think about the unique features that make them stand out from other races as well. And so we've already talked about the beards. That's a pretty big one. And that's kind of why we started with it. It's fun. It's quirky. But at the same time, it's pretty serious. Like, we're pretty serious
iconic
about that. It can be used in some really great ways. But there are also unique features from D&D that the dwarves are known for when you come to play as a dwarf or when you come to use a dwarf. And so, Phil, what would be one of those things that the dwarves are known for?
The dwarves are known, I know one of them is the dwarven resilience. It's kind of one of their racial perks, and that's basically they're going to have advantage on saving throws against poison and kind of resistance to poison damage. This kind of speaks to the hardiness of their nature.
Yeah, I really like that idea when you come up against, when you're in a swamp and you get bit by a snake and the guy's just like, all right, well, I have resistance to poison. I have saving throws against poison. So as many snakes as want to bite me can bite me, but I probably will save it every single time.
Mm-hmm.
And with a high constitution modifier too, because of that,
yeah,
they will probably pass it the whole time, which is part of the reason why I love dwarves, because I think one of the standard things that DMs like to throw in and still throw it in against a dwarf, because it makes for fun role-playing if they do save against the poison, especially for your party. I think there could be a lot of jokes that are made afterwards about the dwarves' resilience not being quite what it should be. But I love being a dwarf for that reason and having dwarves in my campaigns because of their resilience.
Yeah.
I think another thing, too, is their dwarven combat training. And I think this is really fun because, you know, normally if somebody just were, you know, say we're fighting classic Pirates of the Caribbean scene where Jack Sparrow and Will Turner are fighting in that smithy. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, Jack is like losing, it's like at a loss for a sword, and you see him like fighting with all of these different things. I think there's a hammer involved in there.
Yep.
What I love about dwarves is that they can use anything that is an axe or a hammer without limits. So there's no penalties for picking up that weapon. You still get your proficiency modifier for using those things. It's like, oh, your axe broke and you're in this room that has a, you know, classic hammer that we think of or a mallet. You still get proficiency with it. You can still use it. It's awesome. I love the fact that these axes and hammers, there are no limits for dwarves because it's just like you could come up with a really cool weapon idea. It doesn't have to be the typical maul. It doesn't have to be the typical, you know, great axe or whatever, but you find something that looks cool on the internet that's a little bit wonky or weird and still classified as an axe, totally throw that in there. And you could do that with both NPCs and as players that are in your campaigns.
Mm-hmm. You really could. You could even make that like an iconic weapon of a specific clan.
Yeah.
And then your players have never seen this kind of weapon before, but it's going to classify as like an axe or a hammer, and all the dwarves have it. So definitely a cool idea.
Or you could even have the classic one half is a hammer, one half is an axe on the side of it.
The
and they're
axe.
Just proficient with both of them, but depending,
right?
Or the axer, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, the axer. Axer actually sounds way better, but I'm going to keep saying ham axe.
It depends on what you're most proficient or what you want to be most proficient in. You can call it a ham axe, whatever you called it. Ham axe. If you want to be more, you know, hammers are your thing, or if you want to be a more of an axe guy, You could be an axer, you know, whatever floats your boat.
So another thing that is pretty iconic for the dwarves is being proficient with the tools of their trade. So we know that they're very commonly, they're great smiths. We know that they're also really good with masonry and carving out, you know, these stone halls underneath the mountains. So you've got your smithing tools, your mason's tools. Another thing, this could maybe be like even the number four thing that is most motivating to a dwarf, and that's going to be mead or ale of some kind. And so brewer's supplies, that's another great tool proficiency. If you have a player who wants to be a dwarf and he doesn't know exactly what tools he wants to use, throw that his way. Or if you've got, you know, if you're trying to set up a dwarven culture within your world, definitely throw brewer's tools at them and just have them make a ton of mead.
Yeah, I didn't, like when we were looking this up, I didn't know that. I didn't know they were, you know, proficient with brewer's supplies. But that totally makes me want to walk around with brewer's supplies the next time that I play as a dwarf, because that's just so cool to me. Something that nobody else really has, I'm pretty sure, in D&D. Nobody else, I think, is proficient as a race with brewer's supplies, which is really, really fun to think about. Another thing, and you mentioned this a little bit too when you were talking about the masonry, they have the ability to know stone things when they see them, and it's called stone cunning. And so they know they're stones, and you double your proficiency modifier when it comes to stone knowledge or stone history checks. And it's probably one of the things that I love about dwarves. And the last time I played a dwarf, other than Mitch's last campaign where he died on the first night that I played him, I would always walk around and be like, is there stones around? I want to check this stone. Is there anything that I know that's familiar or fancy about this stone? No? All right. Well, next time we're down a hallway, I'm just going to be inspecting it. So if you just want to roll every so often and see if I find a secret door or, you know, find an intricate carving that might mean something.
Yeah.
I want to know about it because stones sometimes have a lot of value to a campaign. They can represent a lot of different things that you might come across. And so I love the fact that they are stone cunning and having a little bit of a masonry background. That kind of helps as well.
Absolutely. And if you think about archaeology and the study of like ancient cultures in our own world, almost all of it comes from us just looking at stones and analyzing what has been carved or etched into the stones. So I think that that's probably a feature that sometimes we as DMs don't use enough when we send people into ancient crypts or dungeons because that's how, you know, all in ancient cultures, we communicated by etching things into stone.
Yeah.
And that can really be a great source of lore about your world and stories for your players to get involved in.
Yeah, I haven't thought about this before, but throwing in archaeologists, having like a clan of archaeologists that are all dwarves that go out and that's their specific job. You know, I've never thought about doing that, but that could be a lot of fun. Like if you were to do maybe an all dwarven campaign and you were to just say, all right, we're going to be an archaeology guild. Now that might sound kind of dull and kind of lame, but you think about all the stories about, you know, we think about going to the pyramids of Egypt and having these traps that happen when you're in there and all these, you know, mummies and things like that. I just wonder how much fun you could get into as a group of dwarves who are part of an archaeologist guild going into these ancient ruins and prying open doors because you know the stonework so well.
Yeah.
That you come across just these fun little encounters.
I don't think there's a limit to the fun, Chris, to be quite honest. And I wouldn't be surprised if you saw a DMnastics cropping up about a dwarf exclusive archaeology guild maybe in the near future.
Yeah, that would be really, really fun to hear. So tune into DMnastics and you can possibly hear some of that pop up.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about dwarves, Phil, we have a couple of sub races that they, you know, we have the dwarven race, which is great, but we also have the sub races that are just subtle enough to the dwarves to make them a little bit more interesting. So why don't you go ahead and talk about the first one that we have?
So the first sub-race that's kind of referenced is the Hill Dwarves. And these dwarves are known for their keen senses and really deep intuition, as well as a really remarkable resilience. I mean, they're already tough because they're dwarves, but since they kind of live out in the hills, they make their homes in the hills, not so much the mountains, I think they're exposed to a lot more of the world around them, and so they become more resilient to a lot of different stuff.
Yeah, I particularly have never played a hill dwarf, but I have played the flip side of the other subrace, the mountain dwarf, which, once again, for whatever reason, when I think of dwarves, I think of like the strong, sturdy, and the mountain dwarf just, I think, over-exemplifies that in my mind as the strong and sturdy. They live in the rugged, difficult terrain. They're constantly having to dig through the mountains. Their hands are calloused and bruised. They're probably bloodied from digging through there, but yet they're strong. You see them carrying around these big old axes and these big old pickaxes and huge chunks of stone. And when I think of the mountain dwarves, that's what I think of. And I think that's why I fall in love with them, because they're like, they're the tough, they're the rugged, built for tough, you know, types of dwarves. And that's why I really like this subclass as well. So if you're looking for a little bit of a tweak on the dwarven class, go check out the 5th edition dwarf subraces from the Player's Handbook. They can get a lot more inspiration from those as well.
If hill dwarf and mountain dwarf aren't enough for you, I know that in previous editions of D&D, there are like gold dwarves, arctic dwarves, wild dwarves. So check out those previous editions and see if, you know, if you as a DM want to allow your players to play as those, maybe try and tweak them so they can fit within whatever rule system you're currently running with.
Yeah, that's a really good idea to go and do. And actually, I probably will do that because I have places in my world where I could probably throw in arctic dwarves because there's mountains and there's ice. It would be perfect. So we love talking about dwarves. We love theorizing about dwarves. We love knowing as much as we can about dwarves. But here at the Dungeon Masters Block, that's not what we're just about. We love to be able to bring you ideas that you can use or, you know, let's just say it, steal for your campaigns. And so what we're going to do now is we're going to go through a couple of ways for DMs that we can use these dwarves and use them really, really well within your campaign. So we're going to start out with some potential, if you have players in your group, as you being the DM, if you have dwarves in your group, we're going to give you a couple of ideas, and hopefully this will spark some interest of moments that you can throw out to your players to really allow them to role play and play their dwarf at their best potential. So the first one, it's kind of what we talked about with the archaeological dwarves, but you find this long lost under mountain temple for whatever reason it is, whether there was an earthquake and the mountain collapsed, which, you know, I wonder if maybe you could throw into your world too. This is a whole nother moment, but dwarves could have these sensors that are able to predict when the earth is going to move. I think that could be really fun to throw in. But so whatever the reason is, this mountain temple has collapsed, and all of your players who are dwarves catch wind of this somehow, whether it's in a class that they're in their home as they're being educated. Maybe it's something that they've become enthralled with throughout the history books. It's this long lost mountain temple that nobody has ever been able to find again. Or they hear it from a passerby, you know, that old guy that comes rolling into town with the multicolored coat telling stories and legends in the town, rolls in and tells a story of this long lost undermountain temple and this great treasure that's within it. And for whatever reason, your dwarven character who is really loving, who really loves stones, comes along and hears this. I have a feeling this character, if you paint the picture just right for him, might want to go on a little bit of a side quest, I would imagine, because of their love for stones. They just can't help it whatsoever. They need to go and figure out what's going on.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the campaign I just ended with my players was very much kind of along these lines. They didn't know it at the beginning, but they were searching for a long-forgotten dwarven stronghold. And when they got in it, they ran into all kinds of fancy, you know, dwarven traps and things left behind. So it's just a great place to kind of role play out. And since dwarves, as we mentioned, are long-lived, my dwarves have a very specific, like, record and lore-keeping. So they found a ton of tomes that were able to uncover, you know, stories from the past.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, too, if it's like this moment where the dwarves know where this place is. They know how to get into it. I wonder what would happen if these dwarves actually knew where this temple was the whole time. But for whatever reason, I mean, they're really good with stones, but there's some sort of magic that's protecting them from even penetrating the stones with what they have.
Yeah.
And so these dwarves who all of this treasure's inside and it belongs to the dwarves, they now have to rely on outside help from a potentially different race. That dwarves have magical abilities, I get that, but maybe you throw it in such a way that they have to get over their sense of, we love dwarves, we want only dwarves to have this place, and to consult outside help to get past this magical barrier that's in there.
Sounds like they need a burglar.
A burglar, yeah, something like that, right? And you have to have them thrown into a situation where maybe the person that can help them is somebody from long ago who they have this quarrel with, and they're the only person in the area that they know that can help them get into this area. I think there's a lot of potential with that one. I think that's a really fun idea for you to take and use within your world.
So an idea I have that kind of exists within my homebrew setting is that within the 10 kind of dwarven clans that exist, the way they decide their next leader, it's not by through like birthright or anything, but it's a massive drinking contest. And whoever can, you know, stay on their feet the longest, that person is going to become kind of the next ruler for the next, you know, 100 years until there's another massive drinking contest. So that could be a fun thing. Maybe you, if you have a dwarf player, maybe they get an invitation to attend this like coronation ceremony, this drinking challenge, and maybe they happen to win. Or maybe a different character, maybe the elf in the party happens to somehow get involved and they win. You could create a lot of bizarre role-playing stuff. And I like that one too because it's non-combat. So it's just going to be, you know, a lot of constitution saves, a lot of jokes, and a lot of fun just based around who's going to become the next king of a dwarven clan.
Well, I almost wonder too if it's like a, you know, if it's just like a one-on-one, like for the protection of my name, for don't, you know, not having my name slandered in front of somebody else, you challenge them to a drinking contest. But the catch is that each dwarf gets to brew their own ale. So you have no idea how strong it is. You have no idea how potent it is. And so you come into this contest, and depending on how well you rolled and depending on how well the other person rolled, you might either be into it for a really long time, or you could be out on the first drink because it's so potent. Yeah. I think that could be a lot of fun too.
And that's a great twist. That's a great twist on like the classic like honor duel of like, oh, you offended me. We're gonna fight to the death now. No, now it's like drink to the unconscious. See like who has more honor and whose honor is defended by the amount of beverages they can imbibe.
Yeah, right. One idea that I'm thinking of right now is, it's a little bit cheesy, but I almost wonder if in the dwarven world, it might be a complete honor thing that you are the only one that can touch your beard. But I almost wonder if there's like a, you know how like there's the barbers that like people go to get their hair cut from because they're world renowned for what they can do with hair. I wonder if in some of these dwarven cities, there's like a beardologist or something like that, that is world-renowned within the dwarven world for how he can sculpt and shape and protect beards. Maybe he has the ability to put spells upon beards so that, you know, they can't catch on fire if they have to go somewhere into, you know, this world that's filled with fire. Or if they're going into battle, they have to all go to this guy because he puts a protection spell against their beard so it can't get cut off or something like that in the battlefield. Or it's just a guy who can simply sculpt beards in really cool ways. And so your character's like, I want to come up with a really cool idea for what my beard is. Like at the beginning of the game, you set out, hey, this is what my beard's going to look like. You come across a picture on the internet later of a cool dwarven beard. Well, the only way you're going to be able to change that, because you don't know how to do that, is go and visit this guy who can do it for you. And so then you have to go through this whole process of, well, how do I get in to see this guy? You know, do we have to go on side quests to be able to do this thing for him? I think that could be really fun. A little bit cheesy, but could be a little really fun for the dwarves as well.
Yeah, I think it's a really fun idea. It makes me think of, like, when you're talking about, like, the protection for the beard before going into battle. For some reason, I started thinking about, like, holy water.
Yeah.
Like, kind of in some of the religions of our world here. And, like, the idea of, like, maybe you have to, like, there's a holy, like, a giant, like, keg of ale or mead, and that you had to go, like, dip your beard in it. To like before going into battle, or maybe that's like how you get initiated into like adulthood or something. There's a lot of things that you could do. So maybe having, and obviously in a lot of stories, like the like clerics or the clergy are kind of involved in like the beard growing and the brew brewing. So that's just another angle of stories to tell if you have a dwarf who is a cleric.
Yeah, I think the more we can incorporate story into these sorts of role-playing moments, the more players will latch onto it and really love it.
There's the classics of, you know, the dragon slaying, the goblin armies. There's nothing wrong with the tropes. Sometimes we want to step away from them as often as we can, but we also want to know that there's a reason why we like them. You know, they make us feel comfortable. So if you have new players, or if you're like me and you're a very new DM, go with some of the more tropey things because they're safe, they're structured, there's a lot of information about how to run them, a lot of resources for how to do, you know, oh, a dragon's coming to attack, or oh, the goblin army is rising. So don't try to reinvent the wheel. Go with what you have a lot of resources for. That's just kind of something I've taken on as being a new DM, and I think it's really helped me.
Well, I think what's great about the tropes too is in those moments, it might seem a little cliche to have the dragon come in, or have the, you know, the goblins try to attack the dwarven stronghold or whatever it is. But in those moments, once you get into those role-playing moments and the dragon speaks for the first time to the group, or the goblins come in and you capture a goblin for the first time, or you see a goblin kill one of your friends for the first time, that's when those tropes pass by.
They fall away.
Yeah, they fall away. Those tropes fall away in those moments. And it's no longer the, oh, this is really cheesy, we're fighting a dragon. It's like, oh my gosh, this dragon just killed a whole bunch of my friends. And now, like, I am emotionally invested into this story. So tropes are an amazing way to go about that.
Because as we mentioned, that's your clan. And that's one of the big three that we want to focus on. You know, if your clan's getting destroyed by a dragon, it instantly fades away from being, oh, this is a retelling of The Hobbit, to my clan is under siege and I am honor-bound to protect them and fight.
Right. Yeah, I think going along the things that dwarves really love, if you were to have like a temple or a statue to Morden in your city and it were to get defaced somehow, like that should send anger pains throughout your whole body as a dwarf. And so you want a dwarf to, you know, flip a lid and start freaking out. Do something to the most sacred person that the dwarves can think about and resonate with. Do something to Moradin's statue and just watch these dwarves freak out. And you could create, I mean, literally, you could create a whole campaign out of that moment where the dwarves wake up and something has happened to Moradin's statue that's in the middle of their city or whatever. I think you could have a lot of fun with that as well. So when we think about dwarves too, maybe we don't have dwarves in our campaigns that our players are playing, but we don't have those interesting role-playing moments to necessarily throw at their character specifically, but we do have the ability to throw dwarves in as NPCs within our worlds. And so, Phil, when an NPC comes to mind, what is one of the classic things you think of for a dwarf?
A classic, I think the most classic one we can think of is the smithy. You know, we've already talked that forging and creating and crafting, you know, whether it's weapons, armor, or items, that's That's a quintessential essence of what it is to be a dwarf, is to be a craftsman, because you have to do it to survive. If you're not crafting underground, then you're just being crushed by stones. So you have to craft to survive. And so I think the classic smithy is the perfect way to go. They're often known as like the finest craftsmen. You've got, you know, whether it's Mithril, whether it's like the hammer from the kind of stories of Driss that Wulfgar has that's made by a dwarf, that you can throw it and it comes back. Like, they're known for making the weapons, and so they're going to be the character that your players interact with the most when they're like, I need a new sword, or I need to upgrade my armor. They're going to go to a smithy, and I think 9 times out of 10, it's going to be a dwarven smithy, and there's a great reason for that.
Yeah, and I think, too, something that's often overlooked with the dwarven smithies is, you know, we think of dwarves as these big, strong, powerful races, but in these moments, you kind of get to see the finesse, and you get to see the dexterity of these guys, of these dwarves come out, because I almost imagine they make these beautiful, beautiful things, and it's not always just smash, 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 you know, bend it into shape by physical force. It's like, no, we have to bend this carefully. We need to buffer this out. We need to polish this type of thing. You know, maybe they go about and they do really delicate like engravings on their swords or on their armor that or their shields or whatever it is in that moment. I think we often overlook the finesse and the beauty that dwarves have in those moments as those smithies as well.
Yeah.
So throwing those types of things in could be really fun.
There's a huge difference between crafting and craftsmanship, I think. You know, it takes a lot of skill to make something at a very high level of detail and
right.
beauty that is also
yeah.
functional.
I think another classic NPC, and we talked about them being proficient in brewing supplies, is the classic barkeep. I think probably 7 out of 10 times a player goes into a bar, it's either a human or a dwarf that's behind the counter. Because let's be honest, dwarves are phenomenal at air. There's a reason why in my world there's the Moonshine Marauder's Mead, which is something that if you listen back to our Dragon Wars episodes, you might hear a little bit about. But there's a reason why now it's well known throughout all of the world, because the dwarves came in, they took over that specific brew, and they've made it into this top-notch ale throughout the world. And so you think about who's behind a bar in a city. It kind of makes sense. If a dwarf is in a city for some reason, they're going to do things that they're good at. They're going to smith, or they're probably going to barkeep. And
yeah,
I think that's a
absolutely.
Great trope to play off of, is the classic barkeep
mm-hmm.
one.
And in a podcast called Crit Juice, which is a D&D actual play, there's a barkeep who brews a ale that is called Dragon's Breath, I believe. And if a player drinks it, then they basically get a short time period where they have a dragon breath attack because the brew is so alcoholic. So there's a lot that could be said about the way they craft their beers and their ales is so much like how they make, you know, the weapons. They're going to be the highest level, the most quality types of brews, and they can may even have some kind of magical component to them.
I think something we often overlook too with the dwarves are they're not just all about gold. You know, they're not just all about having these large lumps of gold around. I think oftentimes they want to craft those things into beautiful things as well. So we think of chains and we think of necklaces. We think of rings that are made by the dwarves. Like, there's a reason why dwarven jewelry is a big deal. So you walk into a town and for whatever reason, you're on a mission for a noble. Like, maybe you need to get some information from a noble, but he needs something in return in order for you to be worthy of getting this information. And he wants a ring made by a specific jeweler who's, you know, hundreds of miles away from here. I think that could be a lot of fun to throw in, is the cool jewelry and maybe even the magically infused jewelry that these dwarves can make as well would be a really cool
yeah.
addition into the world.
In a book that I know both you and I really like, The Silmarillion,
yeah.
There's actually a story of this necklace called the Naglamir, which is made by the dwarves for an elven king. But when they're done making it, it's so beautiful that they refuse to give it up and actually end up killing that elven king to keep it. So yeah, they're not just good at brewing and at weapon making, but anything they attempt to craft, whether if it's using jewels and gold and really precious metals, it's going to come out really gorgeous. And there can be, you know, killing a king is, that's a great start to a campaign.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, like I had never thought about how much emotional effort is put into crafting these things. And maybe it's hard for a jeweler to let that thing go. You know, maybe it's that moment where like he actually sells something and it's like heart-wrenching that he has to sell it, but he understands he needs to do that in order to make a living.
Yeah.
That could be a really interesting twist on somebody who is a dwarf, who is a jeweler as well.
Yeah, and like I mentioned with the smithy idea, you know, in the Dritz stories, Brunor Battlehammer, he makes Aegis Fang for Wulfgar. Yeah. And like giving that, that was his master work. Like he was never going to smith again after that because it was so perfect. Like giving that up, I mean, yes, he obviously loves Wulfgar as like his adopted son, but like that's still got to be a huge kind of weight to hand over the thing that is so good that you're hanging up the apron, you're hanging up the boots, like you're stepping away from the profession because it, you will never create something better than this, and you're handing it over to someone else. Yeah, there's got to be a lot of weight to that.
Yeah, I love that idea of like all of a sudden one day somebody just closing up shop because they made that thing that they realize they will no longer, or maybe it's something that they've been working on their whole life. And they do it little by mm-hmm. little by little, and eventually they get it perfected. Maybe it's this sword that's hanging up when you walk in, and every single time you see the sword, it's getting a little bit more and more done every time you come into the smithy shop. And eventually he just won't take any more orders, and you don't see the sword hanging up anymore because it's finally been perfected, and it can't get any better than that. I love that idea to be able to throw in for dwarves who are smithies in a town.
And then for a plot hook, your players go to visit him again and it's been stolen.
Oh, yeah.
Super easy.
Yeah, right. And he doesn't know how. And you would think that if that's his most prized possession at that point in time, he would have it under lock and key. And so then you realize you're not dealing with just anybody who walked into a smithy and stole it from him. You're dealing with some pretty powerful people at that point in time. And I think there's the classic trope that you can throw in there, the hired muscle, the jailer, the soldier that's on the front lines, strong, powerful, gets the job done. They're the guys going in, swinging the swords, swinging the axes. They're the ones that are on patrol. They're the ones that if somebody escapes, if you get caught by this dwarf, it's not going to bode well for you because they're overly strong and, you know, probably a little ticked off that you got around their defenses somehow. So I think the classic hired muscle trope could be really fun for these dwarves as well.
Any kind of NPC that you need to be kind of a little bit more gruff or slow to warm, a dwarf is a great option for that type of NPC. Another great NPC type is like a mercenary guild leader. So dwarves, as you know, they're gruff people, but they also can be very good leaders. And I see a lot of dwarven societies being based on like your merits, like how good of a craftsman you are, how good of a warrior you are. And so putting that, a person who prizes like, your performance at the leadership of a mercenary guild, those mercenaries are going to be very elite. They're going to be very well trained. And he's going to, be tough on them, but he's going to forge them into a very sharp sword to use for whatever, to the highest bidder. So I think a dwarven guild leader is a really, especially of a mercenary guild, is a great option. So listeners, I hope we gave you plenty of good reasons to include dwarves in your campaigns as NPCs, have dwarven settings and underground fortresses as the places where your campaigns take place, NPCs, plot hooks. We wanted to provide you with all of the great dwarven bearded gloriousness as we could in this very first episode about races.
And so as we talk about dwarves and talking about racial goodness and beard goodness and things like that, we have somebody of the human race that we want to recognize from our Patreon this week. And this week's Patreon is
Chris!
Just Chris. Chris is a feared bronze dragon. So as you see him flying around the forums and around the internet and the Twitter sphere and everything else that he can, I would imagine, be found on, send him a digital high five or a like or a poke if those are even still things now on Facebook. So thank you very much, Chris.
They might be things.
They might be still things. Who knows?
I think it's safe to say that Chris Bronze Dragon might even be an honorary dwarf this week.
Yes, also an honorary dwarf this week. So thank you very much, Chris, for your support. If you as the listener would like to get in touch with us and share stories about how you have used dwarves in the past or how you plan to use them in the future, send us an email at dungeonmasterblock@gmail.com. You can also send us a 5-star review on iTunes. Every review helps to let people know that we are a show actually worth listening to. So head over and get your 5-star review submitted, and it will be read on a future episode. And you can also find us on Podcast Addict and Stitcher as well.
Another place that you can get in touch with us is at DMS_block, and that's going to be our Twitter handle. You can also check us out on Facebook at Dungeon Masters Block for all the news, memes, and all-around D&D goodness you could possibly ever want.
That's all for this episode of the Dungeon Masters Block, the place where we talk about the Dungeon Master, the most important person in the game, the only person capable of playing God,
killing all them characters,
and lowering the egos of all other players at the table.
Have a good night, folks.
That's awesome. Have a good night, everyone.
Goodbye.